Good morning. You're listening to 91.5 KUNV, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Tovin LePan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun, and my co-host, as always, is Andrew Doman.
Hello, good morning.
So there's a lot going on in Washington, D.C. right now. The federal government is very busy trying to avert all kinds of disasters. And so we have on the phone Karin Demirjian, the Las Vegas Sun's political reporter. Thanks for joining us, Karin.
Good to be here.
And so let's start with what I think is at the top of the list, which is the federal budget and trying to avoid a government shutdown. First of all, I was wondering, you know, it seems like now every single year we're sort of getting up against this, you know, threatened shutdown. And I was wondering if you'd give us a little context on sort of how we got to this point in terms of, I mean, it seems, you know, a few years ago or back, you know, maybe 8 years ago, this didn't happen every year that, you know, there was a threatened shutdown.
No, it was a seldom rare occurrence before to have a government shutdown be part of the mix. I mean, they have happened before. There's an infamous one that happened, you know, over the winter 1995, 1996, when Bill Clinton was president and Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House. And there have been a series of other little ones that have happened, you know, in the last several decades, but it's a pretty rare thing to actually get to the point where you are talking about shutting down the government and having no money flowing through the Treasury and having to, you know, pull back on basically federal employees and federal buildings will close and anything that really is wholly dependent on the federal government. It's not an emergency function of the government that has to shutter its doors until Congress works out its differences. But you've had at least the specter of one hanging around most of the budgeting process in Congress for the last few years. And it really is, it's a symptom of the partisan divide that has kind of taken over, you know, the vice grip since Obama got to the White House. The reason that we get into this situation is that, you know, Congress is supposed to have budgets worked out for fiscal years several months before the fiscal years begin on October 1st, and has not managed to do that for the last 7 years running. So that's when we keep talking about continuing resolutions. But every time you talk about a continuing resolution, it seems lately there has been this question of, will they actually make their deadline? It always seems to come down to an 11th hour negotiation process. And then sooner or later, as you near that last 2 week window before the bed drop date, you start hearing people bandy about the term government shutdown as the, you know, the worst case scenario. How bad a scenario that would actually be depends on how long it lasts, whether it's over a weekend, whether it's over a regular vacation period, et cetera. And so the government shutdowns can be, you know, devastating to various degrees. But certainly that has been, it's been a recurrent theme as we've had various fiscal fights over the last few years through this post-recession period.
Right. And I kind of want, you mentioned there those various fiscal fights. Can you help us kind of put it in context? I mean, just for people who hear talk about the sequester, this upcoming debt ceiling fight, a government shutdown, how does it all sort of fit together? How do we make sense of all that? It seems like
sure. Well, I mean, there are different parts of the government's responsibility to keep cash flowing and to pay off our debts and to make sure that we're paying the bills for everything from, you know, active duty military to Social Security checks. We have put these things into this sort of spiraling vortex of simultaneity recently by hinging them together through various stages of the post-recession budgeting response, and also just, you know, Congress trying to leverage certain deals it has to make on the back of other deals that it's going to be forced to make. And that is all a prelude to saying specifically what they are. When we're talking about the debt limit, that is a fight that is going to be coming up mid-October, October 17th, specifically. We're going to hit the limit of what the president and the administration have congressional authority to borrow for. So it's basically like we can't have our national debt go up past a certain ceiling.
So what happens then? Do we default?
That's okay. Sorry?
Do we default at that point? Do we say to
Congress is supposed to give the president more wiggle room, or this is supposed to keep coming up when you talk about a debt ceiling. So is the Congress supposed to give? Congress going to give the president more room to borrow, and how much? If they don't, then that's the question of defaulting on your debt. When you default on your debt, you risk your national credit rating. You risk the U.S. being seen as a safe place for other countries to make investments, and if other countries won't make investments, then you're going to have difficulty borrowing money, and then you're going to have difficulty keeping your basic services running. There is definitely definitely an argument going on and has been for a while in the country about, like, why would we want to have more debt? It's like, okay, well, yeah, you're right. Not everybody likes debt. It's not a great thing to have a national debt. You'd much rather have a national surplus. But when you're talking about just keeping things going, you either have to make drastic cuts, or you have to be able to borrow to be able to continue to pay for the operations that you've already basically contracted out. Like, this is not money that we say, oh, well, let's just borrow an extra $1 billion to have it sitting around for a rainy day. It's money that we've already promised to pay either to China or to something domestically. We have to make good on the contract. And so that's what that's there for. And you're right. Defaulting is what happens if we don't meet the deadlines, if not enough of a cushion is given to continue borrowing to increase that debt ceiling. So that's one, and that is really the most universally devastating. And we've really never hit that point as a country. We know what it's like to deal with government shutdowns. We don't know what it's like to deal with complete pulling the plug on, you know, the United States' ability to say, yeah, we can meet our basic obligations that we make for ourselves. We've come close, but it's never really gone green and over the deep end. The reason that we're having these discussions happening kind of simultaneously is because, you know, back in 2001, there was a big deal made in order to raise the debt ceiling, the debt limit over, we've actually raised the system, but over a long period of time after the summer of 2011, there was a deal made that we're going to make serious cuts to the budget so that we cannot rack up as much of a debt as quickly going forward in the future.
Right, and that was the sequester, right?
That was what eventually led to sequestration. And then sequestration, because we're in sequestration right now, because lawmakers didn't manage to come up with a way to make other cuts to avoid this sort of across-the-board sequester.
Yeah, this was supposed to be a really bad thing.
Changing the amount of money that we're now, that's affecting the budget, because that's now our new budget. And we're so worried we're having discussions about, like, well, you know, what's the level of budgeting that we're going to be doing? What sorts of programs do we want to make sure get budgeted? Maybe, you know, you're working with less money because you've got these strictures of sequestration. So what are you going to put the money in and where are you going to take the money out? And that's where we've come to this current discussion, which is kind of hinging on Obamacare. Republicans are saying, let's pull the plug on all the funding for Obamacare and spend that money other places. Democrats are saying, absolutely no. No, you can't do that. We have to find other ways to raise revenue if we need to. We have to cut certain, you know, tax breaks and loopholes for various programs and industries that don't need it. And we really can't keep making these sorts of cuts. We can't keep cutting this, discretionary spending and social programs and things that people really need, especially in an economic recovery, and expect us to not feel the punch of that. And we're definitely not willing to cut health care.
So, you know, one sort of theme about all these things, the sequester, the debt ceiling showdown, the government shutdown showdown, these are all sort of manufactured crises. Like these things don't necessarily have to happen. We've sort of imposed them on, or Congress has imposed them on itself, it seems like. When does this sort of stop, and when do they get to work on, you know, on other substantial things?
Well, I mean, there are manufactured crises and there are not manufactured crises. I mean, that is, yes, if it needs to come down to the absolute wire and everybody's freaking out and running around like chickens with their heads cut off, screaming government shutdown or default this whole faith and credit of the United States, no, you could potentially work out the differences earlier. That said, you know, the budgeting issues are pretty much like, this is the bread and butter of the Congress's job, is to keep the money funded and to do, you know, appropriating and to do budgeting in a way that says, okay, we can make sure that the United States can continue functioning, can continue balance the books, we can keep the country funded for the things that we're responsible for. So in that sense, I mean, it's the timing of it is definitely manufactured, the substance of it is not, really. Even though a lot of politics being thrown around here, a lot of, especially now in this round where it's hinging on, you know, the healthcare argument that's going to be the healthcare laws that's supposed to be kicking in with the exchange in less than 5 days now. There's a lot of grandstanding happening, that's true. But there's substance to all these issues that are being swirled together at the last minute and creating the last minute tension that we would think, you know, can't you kind of get around this and not do this? It is tabling, though, as you said, because we keep going and lurching from budget crisis to budget crisis to budget crisis, it leaves no time, really, to address things that I'm sure the first thing that's going to come to most people's minds listening is immigration and things like that. You know, we are supposed to be talking about education reauthorization. That's not exactly happening front and center on anybody's consciousness right now. And those sorts of things, because they are not, I mean, those are things that we would like to do, but the budgeting is something that Congress has to do. There is no other option. Like we talked about, if they don't do it, either the government shuts down or the country starts to default, and that's national crisis, real level of tragedy. So it's the imperative must-do-or-die function that they have to fulfill, because they keep lurching like this from every few months to every few months. There is not enough time to work through serious political differences that exist on other substantive issues that aren't do-or-die. Mm-hmm.
And before we move on to the other stuff that Congress, you know, we'd hope Congress will get to, could you tell us, if in the event of a government shutdown, what services, you know, for the general that the general public will notice the most, will we not be getting, and what's considered essential, and will people still be able to get, or, you know, what offices will still be open?
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, you should not expect federal offices to be open, except for if you have a federal court case that is basically already moving through the courts. Can keep functioning for the cases that they are already hearing, although if you're waiting on a court case, it's probably not going to happen. Federal government offices probably shuttered. I mean, yeah, most of them are going to be, 99 out of 100 are going to be shuttered. Federal government employees who are considered, you know, essential or emergency workers may still have to work, but may not be paid right away. The pay may be back paid after the government shutdown is over. For most federal government employees who are not considered to be essential employees or employees in an emergency service, expect a furlough, potentially, for the duration of the government shutdown. Active duty members of the military should expect to have to keep working but not expect a paycheck until the government shutdown is over. Anybody who is on Social Security or Veterans Benefits should expect to continue receiving their checks unless you are waiting for the first one. And in that case, you're probably going to have to wait until the shutdown is over because there's not going to be anyone around to process your claim. Let's see, what else? There's what other areas would be of interest, I guess, to the Las Vegas audience. I'm assuming people that, you know, are planning vacations to D.C. or National Park should be putting on notice, but they won't be able to get in or do anything once they get on. But that is, that's the general scenario for what you're looking at. And I mean, also, I should say that if you are a government contractor or waiting on a government grant for something, it really depends on what stage in your grant agreement you are, in your contract you are. If you already have the money that came from the government to do your job, the assumption is keep doing your job. If you are waiting on the money, again, you got to wait because the people that are processing these contracts, people that are processing claims, are the ones who are going to be furloughed. So that puts a delay on everybody else down the chain.
Right. All right. You're listening to 91.5 KUNV, and this is Neon Eden. We're speaking with Karin Demersian, the Las Vegas Sun political reporter in Washington, D.C. And now, earlier this week, there was some political theater or maneuvering going on. The freshman Senator Ted Cruz from Texas took the Senate floor for, I guess, a whole day, basically. And it was sort of a filibuster that wasn't a filibuster, right? Could you explain to our audience what exactly was happening there?
Yeah, still ongoing dispute in D.C. about this. Is really, you know, insider baseball sort of procedural stuff. But a filibuster is considered a delaying tactic, right? So you filibuster when you want to keep Congress from moving forward with something. The problem with Cruz's filibuster, which went for over 21 hours, which makes it, I think, the fourth longest talking streak on record ever in the Senate,
right,
or at least since 1900, they didn't really keep records of this stuff before then, is that there had already been a time agreement made between Republicans and Democrats that they would burn through the 30 hours of cloture. That's another procedural term thrown out there. Basically, if they're expecting there to be a filibuster threat in order to set up the vote that says you can get the 60-vote threshold, in order to avoid the filibuster, that you have to file something called cloture, and then you have to run the clock for 30 hours. Cruz came in a few hours after that started. They already knew that on Wednesday at 1 o'clock they were going to have a vote. So Cruz basically got to fill all that time, but his filibuster didn't delay anything because that was already the agreement.
Okay, so there was already this 30-hour time frame there in which they were going to wait to have a vote. So Ted Cruz basically decided to fill it for 21 hours. Talking nonstop about defunding Obamacare.
Right. I mean, he was talking about how he wanted Republicans to pursue a certain strategy of voting, basically, plus a whole bunch of other things to fill 21 hours. But so that's the political back and forth about this now, which is that, you know, Democrats are saying, it's not even a filibuster. What are you doing? You're just wasting time. And then there's the other side of it, which is like, well, you know, the press, the politicians, everybody in D.C. has called other similar, not exactly delaying tactic, long talking streaks filibusters when maybe technically they're not. So why pick on Ted Cruz for this one instance when it was still a pretty impressive feat of standing still and talking all night and not going to the bathroom for over 21 hours?
So, and how does the GOP receive? I mean, Ted Cruz, I feel, has ruffled some feathers in his first term and first year, really. And so how is this all going over within his own party?
Well, you know, it's certainly created a bit of a rift because Cruz is basically not just taking aim at Democrats, but he's taking aim at appeasing Republicans as well and basically saying, you know, it's a real easy vote for you if you want to say, oh, sure, I'll take the procedural votes to, and, you know, set up the debate, but to set up the argument on Obamacare, but then, you know, I'm really against it. And that's not the clearest way of saying it, but basically there's two stages that you have to go through for votes like this. One is the procedural vote that, you know, sets up the cloture vote. That is a 60-vote threshold. But then after you get through that cloture vote, when you're doing the final vote on the bill, that's just the normal majority threshold. So do the math. 54 Democrats, not easy to get to 60 votes. 54 Democrats, pretty easy to get to 51 votes on an issue that unites the party. So Cruz's argument is basically like, listen, if you, any of you Republicans think that you can make the argument of like, well, I just want to proceed to the debate, so I will vote for the first cloture vote, you are basically trying to have it both ways, and you can't do that because you're just, the vote for that enables Harry Reid to get a simple majority vote to fund Obamacare. That is basically verbatim his line that he was repeating all night the other night in his long, little bit of filibuster talking streak. And the thing is, like, this is an argument that comes up all the time. Basically, any time you hear these arguments about the procedural filibuster, this is the push and pull. If it's a procedural filibuster on the motion to proceed and or on the bill before it gets its final vote, they really are arguing about whether they're going to let this last stopgap threshold clear before you actually have the real vote. It's why Harry Reid always is saying, you know, You can't object to having the debate. You can't object to having the debate. You can object to the actual bill or to the actual nominee or on the vote, but stop objecting to having the debate. And Republicans say, but that's our only way to really, really undo the majority, because if we get to a simple majority vote, we can't stop the Democrats from winning. In this circumstance, there's a lot of Republicans who would like to be able to say, look, I'd like to proceed to the debate, because they know how high the stakes of this issue are. You cannot actually back Cruz all the way and avoid a government shutdown. Yeah, Cruz and his supporters are saying, well, look, easy. You know, Harry Reid and Democrats can just agree to defund Obamacare. We're 4.5 days. When you are saying that 4 or 5 or 6 days before the actual date at which the exchange is supposed to open, it's not going to happen.
Well, right,
there's no way that's going to happen after several years of fighting over this. So really, there is no way to both support Cruz and avoid a shutdown. And that's what other Republicans are looking at, saying, this is not worth the fight right now.
Well, that's what I was hoping to get to.
Even if we don't agree.
With the defunding of Obamacare, I mean, I got to say, I'm watching this in D.C., but back here in Nevada, it looks to me like a lot of Obamacare in this state is already funded. I'm seeing advertisements on TV that have been paid for through federal government contracts. There's these so-called navigators who are paid through federal government contracts who are going out to try to help raise awareness and get people enrolled in this exchange, this health insurance exchange that's going to launch, as you said, at the 1st of October. So it seems to me a bit that, what are we actually talking about when we say defund Obamacare? Is it just something that sounds good, or is there actually funding out there that still hasn't been released that could actually, you know, throw a wrench into the implementation of this law?
Yeah, well, that's the immediate irony, basically, of it, which is that even if you did vote to defund Obamacare for this fiscal year, it wouldn't do any good for holding up the opening of the exchanges, because that's going to happen anyway. And like you said, it's mostly contract-based for the money that's already been dispersed, at least to get you through this opening round. This all comes from a strategy that basically, you know, a few months ago, that the conservative community was like, all right, look, our repeal thing obviously isn't working. We've had like 40 votes on that in the House, and it's not going ahead. So if we can't have the Senate pick up any of these votes to repeal Obamacare, then maybe what we can do is defund it, and we can hold up the budget process. Yeah, it's going to be an annual fight, and that's going to stink out loud. It's going to be annoying because we can only defund it a year at a time. But that seems to be a much more viable alternative for going ahead with it. And so you had a lot of Republicans who had been like, okay, well, it's a long line, there's nothing we can do. Be like, actually, maybe we can do something. Maybe we can take money away. I mean, there's various things you can defund. There's the implementation officers of the IRS whose salaries are going to be paid out of annual appropriations. You can take that money away if you want to. Remember, only half of this law is actually going into effect on October 1st. There's a year delay for any of the business mandates. That's going to affect the way that the compliance mechanisms are adjudicated, the way that fines are, you know, meted out and everything like that. And there have to be people behind each of those things. And as the exchanges potentially expand to take on more individuals, if more businesses move towards not insuring their employees, as actually has been a trend that's trying to aggregate unions right now, then you need, you know, more of the oversight functions there. And that all costs more money down the line. So while you're right that none of the defined sort of messages can undo what has been done, it can certainly hamper what is to come down the line. And we already know it's going to take at least another year to get this thing fully up and running, and there has to be more money to go towards that, at least at the very minimum, for the people who are going to make that happen.
And Karina, you know, you mentioned earlier the in one of these things that Congress has on its plate, but really can't get to without getting past this budget, is immigration. And then there's a broad coalition of people who worked really hard this year to try sort of get it through the Senate, and then and now the House is sort of stalled out in the House. And what do you see happening? What are the next steps? Are we going to get to immigration reform this year?
It's not going to happen, in my view, before Halloween. That would be the best, really general time frame in which you might see a return to immigration. Right now, it's, you know, we're dealing with a current budget crisis that has to be resolved by October 1st, or if there's a shutdown, you know, a few days after October 1st. And October 17th is the deadline for the, October 17th is the deadline for raising the debt limit. And then it may be over, but it may not be over, because the Senate's version of the budget bill to avoid the government shutdown takes you through November 15th. And November 15th is only about less than a month after October 17th. So, again, you've got another lurching deadline. And if the House happens to prevail in this, then, you know, they only actually want to extend it to December 15th. So this continuing resolution is only a few months long. It's not actually long enough to be like, all right, we're in the clear for the rest of the fiscal year. Let's turn our full calm attention now to immigration. It is going to be hovering there at least until Thanksgiving, potentially until Christmas. That is going to make it difficult to have a exclusively focused, well-reasoned, emotional but not like crazy tied to other sorts of things and other political chips, emotional debate in the House and certainly across Congress. It can happen simultaneously, but the fact that you've got at least two, if not three more, really kind of jump on from to get the budget thing resolved past the end of 2013 means there's distractions along the way. And that's usually what ends up deep fixing these sorts of initiatives.
And if it doesn't get done in 2013, in your view, what's the likelihood that it gets taken up in, you know, a midterm election year next year?
Well, I mean, I don't want to speculate. There's certainly several months of the year to have it be taken up in 2014, but it does seem like, especially for the House, it's going to be a difficult sort of a sell of an issue, at least before the primaries are done. So that, you know, when we're in 2014, we're definitely in Republican primary season. It's not an easy vote for a Republican who's got a challenger to take. So that takes us through, what, the summer, basically, where it's kind of the live third rail of the topic that no one's going to want to touch. Then once we're in the summer of 2014, it's only a few, you know, a short set to the actual election day. And that could be a difficult time to take this sort of vote. It could either be a time to take the vote, which actually pays many dividends for certain challenged Republicans, or it could be a time that complicates the election calendar, and it's going to depend on how people view it then. And then there's always a lame duck period. And actually, I'm not going to be the first person to say that the lame duck period might yield the best chance of not take great chances as if it was done quickly to resolve the immigration issue, depending on what Dana decides to do, depending on what the outcome of the election is, depending on how, you know, morally compelled the leadership is to do something about it while they have the current Senate bill done while they have current control over the chambers being what they are before that potentially changes in 2015. So it really, you know, it's really going to, the end of the year, 2013 and 2014 might actually be the best zone. And it will probably also depend in large part. I mean, if it doesn't get done by the end of 2013, it's going to be an issue on the campaign trail again, which is the one thing that doing it by the end of this year avoids. You avoid having it be a major issue on the campaign trail. If it is a major issue on the campaign trail, you know, that in 2012, that is what really pushed the Republican Party to a position where you saw so many senators saying, I'm going to take up this issue, I'm going to make an issue, where you've seen members of the House from districts that have large immigrant populations saying, yeah, I'm going to make an issue that I want to, you know, push for too. If you have one more election like that, it does a similar sort of a message, then you might actually have real reasons to do that in a lame duck. But if you don't get it done in a lame duck, then the Senate bill goes away and you've got to start from scratch all over again.
Wow.
A lot of ins and outs.
Yeah. So we have a few minutes left here, and I just want to sort of switch gears a little bit. You have a unique perspective being out there in D.C., and I kind of wanted just to hear your thoughts perhaps on sort of how our Governor Brian Sandoval is viewed out there in the D.C. world. I know sometimes I read stories from journalists out in D.C. about Brian Sandoval. What kind of guy is he viewed as?
You know, it's there hasn't been as much discussion about Brian Sandoval in, you know, the recent months just because everybody's been so singularly focused on these sorts of measures. I mean, I think he works pretty well with the delegation. The Nevada delegation seems to actually speak of him that they've got a fairly decent working relationship from both sides of the aisle. I know his name was bandied about when we were in the 2012 election season as being one of the rising stars of the party. He's not been so much of a rabble rouser as other Republican governors from like the northern Midwest, really, and you know, the South have been trying to kind of make a bit of a name for themselves with certain issues involving unions or involving social issues, and they'll state based laws on that. So I think he's still pretty well respected among the national governors, but I mean, to be perfectly honest, except for an issue that really directly involves what Nevada is doing, like things like the DOE energy spent fuel shipments and other things that are issues that kind of hit Nevada at the center, it's not a the Brian Sandoval gossip is not like a national conversation right now. So I'm sure that may, though, change soon rather than later as Nevada heads to... it's into the, you know, gubernatorial election season. Right now, when we talk about governors, everybody is so focused on things like the Virginia race because of the rank, you know, because it's right now front and center happening every week, that I think people haven't turned their heads entirely to the state-by-state map of the country and how that may shift and change and what that may yield in the states. So we shall see what, I guess, that all... how that transpired.
Well, I think actually that's all the time we have. We'll bring you back sometime in the future. But that we've been talking to Karin Demersian, the Las Vegas Sun political reporter in Washington, D.C. Thanks for being with us today, Karin.
Thank you.
And you've been listening to Neon Eden on 91.5 KUNV. Our producer is Richard Riegel. My co-host is Andrew Doman. I'm Tobin LePan. See you next week.